colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's call this meeting to order, though we have a very small contingent, but we have our speaker's parents. So this will be a very formal and very short and thing. We're lucky today to have Rebecca Stein, who's a professor at Duke of Anthropology. And she's, we keep talking about the thing that's changed so much is social media. And what Rebecca Stein has done is tried to show how social media interacts with the conflict and the various groups within the conflict. Mm-hmm. And before I start, let me just do one thing here. And that is, I'm going to stop that share and start a new share to just show you where we're going to be next week. So coming up, we have three talks in a month. Uri Talil, who sit here on this meeting, is going to talk about is Israeli-Palestinian peace resolution still attainable? Mm-hmm. The answer we all know is no. A month later, we have Thayer Dalasha, who is a 48 Palestinian living in this country. Mm-hmm. And he's going to talk about as a third intifada about to start. Mm-hmm. And a month later, we have Chuck O'Connell and Dick Plotkin, who will give a critical analysis of Ken Burns' Holocaust film. Mm-hmm. So with that, I will. Rebecca has asked that we each introduce ourselves. So I'm going to let most of the introduction for her start with her. So we're going to start with Uri and Dick and Tony, and I guess Professor, the older Professor Stein, and we'll each take a minute or so to introduce ourselves. Uri?
Oh, I'm going first. I thought the professor was going first.
I'm happy. Yeah, should I go? I'll just say I'm happy to be with everyone tonight. I'm really impressed by the history that you've outlined, and I'd love to hear more about it. But I'm a professor at Duke. I've been here for almost two decades, and I work on Israel-Palestine, and I have this work and my own work as a professor and as a teacher comes out of an activist commitment. And that's what I'll be talking about tonight. I'll be talking about my most recent work. So I'll say more about that in a minute.
Mm-hmm. So my name is Uri Talil. I was born, raised, educated in Israel. I immigrated to this country in 1971. And I basically told everybody that I'm a political exilee by choice. I didn't like the Israeli politics in 67. And in my opinion, it was going nowhere with regards to settling the issue with the Palestinians. In the 80s, I was involved with a group of people here in the United States with an organization that was called the Foundation for Middle-East Communication. And for the better part of 6-7 years, we were doing workshops in the United States, in Canada, and Israel, where the workshops got Israelis, Palestinians, Arabs, and Jews, and other people interested in the subject, talking politics, especially talking politics of the Middle East, especially talking the politics of the Israeli-Palestinian-Arab conflict. And in 1991, we kind of like disbanded after Israel went to the Madrid conference. And
Marshall.
I'm sorry? And he went to the Madrid conference, and we felt like, okay, and we kind of impacted something, and then got the Oslo, and then in 1995, when Rabin was assassinated in the center of town in Tel Aviv as a reigning prime minister, that's when I realized that, unfortunately, it's going the wrong direction, but in a way, I was kind of like born into the conflict, and it's very hard for me to give up, even though at the back of my mind, I'm very, very pessimistic about it. So I joined this group about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, and I find very interesting diversifying opinions on the issues, but pretty much from people who have a long history and experience in dealing with the issues. So I enjoy those meetings. Thank you.
Thanks, Uri. Dick?
Yeah, I go way back as well. I was involved in something called the Radical Zionist Alliance in the early 1970s when we were kind of Bear Borukhov socialist Zionist types. And my interests in the subject kind of waned over the years, but fate had me marry someone from Israel. So I've made many trips back to Israel with her and her family. And I have a daughter who's a social worker who got a fellowship in Israel, and she ended up marrying an Israeli Palestinian who's actually going to talk to us about the prospects of another intifada. So events keep bringing me back to the topic, and my views have evolved and changed over the years. I no longer subscribe to the views of socialist Zionism.
Tony?
Yeah, my name is Tony Litwinko. I'm an ex-academic. For 25 years, I was in the insurance business, so that my association with the Israeli-Palestinian thing has mostly been on an intellectual level. Actually, I was brought to it as an English major because of Edward Said's work, and had read him all the way through. When I retired from the business in 2006, and after about a year or so, I got involved in a trip to Gaza, and that's where I met Jeff for the first time. We were delivering aid to the Gazans after the 2007-2008 war. And after that, my association just deepened with this organization and with Friends of Sabeel. I've got a lot of friends in that organization, and have spent a number of visits to Israel. I'd say probably about 9 or 10, touring of the West Bank and the state itself. My stepson, Michael Schaefer Omerman, is married to a human rights attorney, Emily Schaefer Omerman, who argued cases in front of the Supreme Court in Israel. And Michael is now the director of research for Israel and Palestine at Dawn, the foundation that Jamal Khashoggi put together. I still have very close ties with 972 magazine, and talk frequently with the managing editor of it, Haggai Matar.
Thanks, Tony. The elder Professor Stein.
Thank you for letting us join you. I'll let my wife be the main speaker at this moment because I'm losing my voice to the seasonal ills. But I'll say briefly that I'm a retired English professor. I've taught at Harvard, Berkeley, and then for the last 36 years at the University of Oregon. We moved to LA 10 years ago, and we've been involved in some organizations not dissimilar to yours, I suspect, since coming here. But the main labor of love in our life, of course, has been raising two brilliant academic daughters, of whom we all have the pleasure of listening to Rebecca today. And she's the one, I think, who has made us most aware of issues having to do with war and peace and Israel, justice, and Palestinian plight. Although in Eugene, as my wife can say more about, we were very much involved in an extremely progressive synagogue that for years was speaking on behalf of Palestinian rights. And in fact, we imagined or fantasized that our rabbi in very early years, perhaps going back to 1980, was one of the first American rabbis to use the word Palestinian in his sermons. It was not only taboo, but considered to be a non-category at that time. Carol, you may want to add more.
Yes, I think that Rebecca was always influenced by our beloved rabbi, Myron Kinberg, who really believed in Palestinian-Israeli coexistence deeply in his heart. And it was part of our lives that Palestinians were not called Arabs, that they were people with their own beliefs and respect. We respected them. And we had some of the mayors, Do you remember when the mayors, of course, were being, their lives were in danger? They came and spoke. We had soldiers who were involved in the peace movement stay at our house. So it's been part and parcel of our Jewish lives. And I, for that, I feel very fortunate, because when I'm now living in Los Angeles, I find the Jewish newspaper to be so reactionary. I just can't fathom that it's come to this, that Jews are so focused on anti-Semitism and nothing else. And I find it very discouraging. But anyway, we hope for the best, and I appreciate all that you people do.
Well, thank you. Let me just add that Dick Plotkin didn't say, but he has a degree in sociology, who was matching our speaker. And I have not, my history has not been that long, could fit 40 years I worked for the man. Although my mother was born in Tiberias when it was an Ottoman, when it was part of the Ottoman Empire. And since retirement, I have worked on this subject because I can't stand the Israelis committing crimes and claiming they're doing it for me. With that, I'm going to pass the floor back to Rebecca, who will tell us about how modern technology is impacting the conflict. Rebecca?
Great. And I want to just say, I really appreciate hearing everybody's personal story. It's powerful for me to hear. I'm going to share my screen here. Let me change my view. No, that's not what I want. Sorry. Okay. So I'm going to just talk for a little while. I mean, since we're a small group, I think it's, I want to keep my comments as short as I can. But just to give you a little bit of sense of the issues that have concerned me over the last decade, and how I came to them, and what it means in particular for an anthropologist. Although I am an interdisciplinary scholar, my primary methodology in these works is ethnography. What it means for an anthropologist to come to these particular issues, because that's also an important part of the story, because it's different than a political scientist, it's different than a journalist. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. But for the last decade, and starting with this book, which I published with a co-author, Adi Kunstmann, in 2015, I've been thinking about the interplay between military occupation and new media technologies, and really asking the question, how the proliferation of these technologies, which of course they're proliferating across the globe, obviously, but how the proliferation of these technologies in Israel-Palestine is shifting the political theater of military occupation. So I'll say that I began this project, I began both of these books at the same time in 2010. And 2010, as we may recall, was the time of the Arab uprisings, which was, known for some time as the Arab Spring. And if you recall the stories of the Arab Spring, that those were popular revolutions, grassroots pro-democracy revolutions that were said at the time to rely heavily on social media and digital technologies. And that really spurred my interest in asking the question, these technologies have been so important in this political mobilization, what role are they playing in Israel-Palestine? So I really marked 2010 as the beginning of my growing attention to how these technologies were changing this political playing field. So I don't need to show you this map. You know what the military occupation looks like. I'm showing you this image because it was the image for which the cover of this book is inspired. This is a book, so if my previous book, Digital Militarism, I'll just go back there for a second. You see this image on the cover of the soldier looking at his phone. You'll notice that it's not a smartphone. This is sort of pre-smartphone days. But this is a book that was interested in, within this broader project of how new media technologies have changed the occupation. This book is particularly interested in social media, and it's particularly interested in military usage of social media. So while there's been heavy usage of social media on the Palestinian side as a liberatory tool, this book comes at it from the other direction to ask, how were these technologies important in maintaining military rule? How were they pulled into the toolboxes of the military? how were they pulled into the toolboxes of everyday Israelis who wanted to support their military occupation? So this is why the title is what it is, digital militarism. Of course, many books have been written about the other side, sort of digital liberation, but that is not this project. This project is very much thinking about how these tools aid and abet the military occupation project. And I can say more about that book, but through social media. That's not the book I'm talking about today. Today I'm talking about this book, which takes up again the similar question, which is, how have these new digital technologies shifted the political arena? But it's chiefly interested in camera politics. So this is, you see this very, very familiar posture of the soldier trying to keep the journalist from photographing this image of a detention underway. I believe this is shot in Jerusalem. So this is, and this is one of the subjects I take up in the book, is the military's anxiety and attempt to respond to the growing number of cameras that are on the ground in the hands of Palestinian activists and human rights workers. So I'll skip this slide, but this is a slide that reminds us that there's very long histories here. We might get into those histories later. So, there's nothing new about the politics of the camera, of course. These are two books that address the 19th century relationship between politics and cameras in this part of the world. But I'm interested in this more current moment. And I'll just quickly share a set of slides with you, which shows the range of folks that I talked to for this book. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with anthropology as a discipline, but what we do, our bread and butter, our methodological bread and butter, is interviewing people, is watching how societies function. So for me, this was spending time with, I don't know if folks recognize him, but this is Bilal Tamimi, who's from the famous Tamimi family in Nabi Saleh, who's a very famous activist. And as folks I'm sure know in this space, this is a community that has been very much involved in activism against the separation barrier and against the occupation, but cameras and social media have been an important part of their toolbox. So I spent time with Bilal Tamimi, I spent time with Palestinian activists who are using their cameras as tools in new ways. I spent time with the military. So like my previous book, this book is very much interested in not only cameras as activism, but also cameras as tools to perpetuate military rule. So this is an older image, deliberately so, of the military's camera unit. The military's camera unit dates back to 1948. That's a history I trace in the book. Briefly, there's nothing new about the military having cameras when they go to war, having film crews. This is very, very old. But the camera crews would have a new function. There'd be new kinds of cameras on the scene in the last decade. And I was particularly interested. This is an image shot by Bilal Tamimi of one of a famous piece of footage that I'm guessing some of you may have seen as people in this room know, one of the standard things that families in Nabi Saleh face are night raids on their homes, waking children in the middle of the night out of bed, et cetera. This is an image of one such raid at 2 a.m, but you'll see that the soldier is filming the family with his own personal iPhone. So this is something that I paid a lot of attention to, is again, how did civilian technologies find their way into military arsenals in the last decade and a half? And there's a kind of confusion between, is it a military tool? Is it a personal tool? When is the camera being used for military purposes? When is it being used for personal purposes? This is something that I very much followed. So again, the military is the central part of the story, and I'll say more about that in a minute. Settlers. So if you see this guy with the red circle around him, this is from 2012. So I've spoken now about Palestinian activists. I've spoken about the military's film unit. Jeff, you might want to mute. This is an image from 2012 of a settler using a camcorder. And interestingly, settlers were late to the scene. They were late to the game. I mean, this book, makes the point, which we now know, this book screenshots, which is that all the players in the military occupation would be forced to incorporate networked cameras, internet-enabled cameras, into their toolbox, right? And they did it at different paces and in different ways, but that was not an option, right? They all had to learn how to use digital media, and they all did, and they'd all increasingly rely on digital media as a political tool. Settlers, interestingly, came rather late to the scene, but they did. Now that it's very standard that settler raids happen with cameras as part of the operation. This was an early moment of that. And interestingly, I learned doing the research for this book that it was so important for settler media organizations to have cameras that they were given permission by whatever relevant Rebbe to shoot on Shabbat. That's how important the camera was considered as a settler tool of incursion, and obviously incredibly violent incursions as well. Now, here we see an image of a Palestinian photojournalist hiding behind a car. So there's the point of this image is to say the obvious. Cameras have been on the scene long before the digital moment, but this book is interested in how this how all this politics shift in the digital moment. Now there's another body of actors that have not been mentioned, but I'm gonna come back to them, and that's human rights workers. So I'm sure everyone here is familiar with the history of B'Tselem. B'Tselem plays a very, very big role in this book. That is part of my ethnography for this project. I spent time with B'Tselem's camera crew, which was established in 2008 in Hebron. And I'm sure folks are familiar with the history of B'Tselem, but they established a camera project well before Palestinians living under occupation had access, popular access to camera technologies. They were distributing cameras to families living in high conflict zones, families who would often facing violence from settlers and soldiers. So their camera project, which I assume folks know about, but I can talk more about, is a central part of this story. And in fact, this is footage shot by a B'Tselem, a volunteer. I talk a lot about this particular piece of footage. This is shot in 2008 by a member of a young Palestinian woman living in the Susia area, which is, as folks may know, is obviously under heavy attack by surrounding settlements. And she shot this footage in 2008. What follows in this footage is the beating by these masked settlers of her and her aunt and uncle. So what I'm doing in the book is chronicling the experience of these very different communities: human rights workers, Palestinian activists, Palestinian civilians living under occupation, the military, settler communities. I'm chronicling how they all began to pull these different kinds of digital cameras into their political toolbox and what difference it made for them, and you know what they did with their cameras. And how they worked for them. So this is where the book goes, and I'm happy to entertain. I'm going to keep going, but I'm not going to be able to talk in detail about all of these communities. Why does it not want me to? Oh, here we go. This is actually this takes us back to 2010. This is an image from the Arab Spring. Okay, I want to spend a minute before we open up to questions with the military's. With the military's social media team, to which I had rather bizarre access. So we might talk about that. That was one of the sort of more surprising pieces of the book, is that why would these guys let me talk to them? Well, they did. And this is not an image that I shot, but this is an image from the early years of the social media team. And you know, I think one of you talked about, I think, touring Gaza in the course of right after the 2007-2008 war. Who was that? I can't remember. One of you talked about that. I'm not seeing everybody on the screen, but Tony, that was you maybe? You went to Gaza right after 2007, 2008? One of the things that's chronicled in both of these books is the emergence of the military's interest in social media as a political tool. It begins during the 2007-2008 incursion into the Gaza Strip, codenamed Cast Lead. I'm sure folks remember that was the first of the three first of four assaults on the Gaza Strip that would happen in this period. And in the book, I talk about their kind of happenstance and rather improvisational move into social media with these very kind of rudimentary blogs. And particularly, they also, their early foray into social media starts with drone imaging, an imaging of Air Force assaults on the Gaza Strip of this kind, footage that we're quite familiar with, but at the time was very new. And I should say, the military, when I would speak with them, was very, very proud of these efforts. And one of the things that they liked to tell me was, you know, we were the first military to get on social media. They told the kind of pioneering narrative. You know, we're the first media to, but Israel got there first. Netanyahu, of course, as we know, has been a famous player on social media. But the military's history is very interesting in this regard, and they were very proud of it. So they start with 2007, 2008, and their work with social media builds from there. And I talk a lot about this in the book. And I spend a lot of time talking about all the mistakes that happen and their kind of ham-handed usage of these technologies in an attempt to tell the world their side of the story, right? Which that was very important to them. So here I have some, in the longer version of this, I spent a lot of time talking about these particular images, which we won't be able to today. One of the things I think is quite interesting, we talked about 972, a publication which I am absolutely indebted to, such an important publication. I mention it because this is a shot that was reproduced in 972. This is from the 2012 subsequent incursion into the Gaza Strip and Israel's targeted assassination of Jabari here. And I'm showing this because one of the pieces of the story of the military's foray into social media is their repeated attempts to sort of bring global eyeballs to their content. I'm sorry to talk about a targeted assassination as content, but that's what it was, right? You notice how strange this is. It's in the style of a movie poster. It's cherry red. The military really believed in bringing all eyeballs to their military, what they perceived as their military successes. The military would speak quite proudly of this, but obviously this is a very disturbing image, and we could spend a lot of time talking about it. This is again from 2012, as the military is still sort of trying to figure out what does a military do on social media. I mean, this is one of the most interesting things I heard when I would spend time with their social media team, asking them, what are you doing? And they would say to me, you know, it's hard for a military to get on social media. It doesn't make any sense. You know, they would say, we're a top-down institution. What does it mean for to produce content like this? So the book is partially a chronicle of that strange effort to bring a military occupation onto social media. And what that means in part is you have to live by the rules of this thing, which in part is you're playing for eyeballs. You're part of the attention economy. So when you assassinate someone, you turn them into a movie poster. So that's part of the storyline here. Again, I can say more about that. So the military was really struggling to speak the vernacular language of social media during this time, like things like this, right? That's a big part of both of these books. Jeff, should I take 5-10 more minutes? What are we thinking? You're muted, so I can't hear you.
Whatever you feel comfortable with.
Okay, let me show two more examples then. So let me hang out with the military just a minute more. So while both of these projects on media spend time with the military in an attempt to understand what they were doing in the digital age, it also looked at content produced by soldiers. And one of the cases which I found particularly illuminating as a way to think about the strange interface between digital culture and militarism was, the 2012 military incursion into the Gaza Strip. And this was the first time, and these are all images, selfies really, also of soldiers taken after they had been deployed, but they had not yet entered the Gaza Strip. They were waiting on base to enter the Gaza Strip for a ground incursion. As you'll recall, there was no ground incursion of the Gaza Strip in 2012, but they were waiting, is this 2014? I think this is 2014. Let me get my dates right here. No, 2012, I was right. So they'd been deployed, the ground troops had been called up, they were waiting on base for a ground incursion, which would never happen, and they had their cell phones with them. And this was the first incursion into the Gaza Strip in which smartphones proliferated among the military. And they shot a lot of selfies. And those selfies lived online, right? Anyone could access them. So I spend a lot of time with these selfies. My particular favorite one is this. So these are, again, soldiers. They've been called up. They've been deployed. They're waiting to go into the Gaza Strip. As we know, this was another brutal incursion, which would claim many civilian Palestinian lives and devastate the infrastructure. But what it produces is this weird body of media, which is at the intersection of kind of fashion selfies and lethal militarism. And I'm proposing that we really need to take this intersection seriously, this weird intersection of popular culture and militarism, because I think it tells us a lot about the ways in which Israelis live with their occupation and how it lives in the world every day. So I spend a lot of time talking about the ordinariness of these images and what it tells us about Israeli society in the present day. And I can talk more about that. But I think we should take selfies seriously. This is part of the proposition. Let's take selfies seriously as political documents, because I think we have to in the digital age. And I'll also say that this body of material, one of the things I pay a lot of attention to is the evolution of military policy governing social media usage by those in the armed forces. So you might ask, why did the military allow this content to go online? So one of the things I follow is the belabored and belated effort of the military to catch up to the action of soldiers on the ground. They were always behind the ball. So they labored to develop policy that would meet, that was robust enough to actually respond to the ways in which soldiers were using their technologies. And they were often behind, which is why some of this content lived online the way it did. Okay, so I talked about B'Tselem, and this is the last case I want to talk to you about. So I spent a lot of time with B'Tselem with their camera project. I can talk about that later if folks are interested. But one of the things that I thought about was how B'Tselem and other human rights organizations, but as folks may know, B'Tselem obviously is the most important Israeli and oldest Israeli human rights organization working in the occupied territories, but how they began to change their techniques of evidence collection, of testimonial collection, and also their legal work as cameras began to proliferate. So what we're looking at here, and these yellow circles are around two CCTV cameras that are at the site of this execution in Bitunia on Nakba Day in 2014. So this is a case that B'Tselem worked on, and it was the killing of two Palestinian youth at the site. It was the very famous case. I suspect folks have read about it. But B'Tselem issued a dossier about this case, which these images are from that dossier. And at this moment, so I followed this case. Why did I follow this case? Because in 2014, it was considered the case, in fact, it was written a lot about in 972, it was considered the case with the greatest body of videographic evidence supporting the claim that soldiers had fired on these youths and killed and resulting in a lethal shooting. In 2014, it was the case with the largest body of videographic evidence supporting B'Tselem's claim that soldiers were responsible for the death of these youths, despite the fact, it will not surprise you to learn, that the military denied responsibility for the shootings. So, and part of the body of forensic videographic material comes from these two CCTV cameras. So in screenshots, I walk through the history of this case. And the reason I walk through the history of this case is I'm interested in how human rights organizations, in a way not that dissimilar from the military, had to pull cameras into their toolbox. They had to figure out, how does footage fit into the way we do human rights work? And it was a learning process for them, just as it was for the military. And one of the learning processes was I sat down with several folks in B'Tselem. I was good friends with the director of B'Tselem at the time, and they said to me, "We've failed before. Prosecutions of soldiers are incredibly rare. There's rarely justice brought in the case of a soldier violence. But in this case," they said, "we're going to succeed." Why were they so confident? because of the videographic evidence. Never before had there been such a volume. Well, it will not surprise you to learn that justice was not done in the legal system, that despite the volume of videographic evidence that there was, the evidence would be repudiated, that the soldier would serve very, very minimal jail time. And it was a learning, it was a lesson for B'Tselem. Now, part of the lesson for B'Tselem in this famous case, these are shots from some of these CCTV cameras. Again, there were many cameras, or five cameras focused on the scene of the shooting. And two of these are CCTVs. One was shot by a CNN photojournalist. One was shot by a Palestinian photojournalist. I'm not going to show you that footage today. But one of the lessons learned in this case from 2014 was how, and this precedes Trump, right? We're pre-Trump here. One of the lessons was how easy it was for Zionist audiences in Israel and elsewhere to look at the footage and say, it's fake. This was well before we had that language of fake news in our arsenal, before we were acquainted with the language of fake news in the United States. But B'Tselem was learning, along with the rest of the world, that actually it was very easy to look at this material and call it fake. Now, I'm pulling this. This is a screenshot from one such video, from one such website. The reason victim is in quotes is because the claim here is this guy's an actor, right? So this was a crisis actor narrative, the same kind of narrative that would emerge in Sandy Hook. It happened in Israel much earlier. What's the argument? He's not really dead. In fact, the military wasn't really there. This Palestinian is staging his injury for the benefit of those CCTV cameras that were on the scene. And this was a very popular theory, and it would begin to develop, and it would consolidate into something folks are probably familiar with, this neologism, Pallywood. And what is Pallywood? It's the Palestinian industry in fake death and injury for the camera. And it's become a very popular claim on the far right. So this book does the work, which I think is really important for us in the, you know, I was writing it in the Trump era. It's important for us in the present as well. It traces how a fringe conspiracy theory, this is going to sound very familiar to us, how a fringe conspiracy theory about Palestinians faking their death or injury would move from the margins of the dark web to the center, to the center of the Israeli social body. And it would eventually be endorsed by Netanyahu himself and others. It would become a state explanatory narrative. And what I'm arguing in the book, and this is pushing beyond where we are, but what I'm proposing in this book is that we should think about the rise of this story here. I'm just reminding us of our broader context. We should think about fake news in the Israeli context, in this context. Think about the charge of faking it as a way to handle the problem of growing digital literacy among Palestinians. Why? Because Palestinians during the course of the last two decades had more and more access to digital technology. And YouTube was increasingly functioning as basically an archive of Israeli state violence. And that was a problem. And that was a problem that those on the right had to solve. They had to deal with this footage that was very damning. So one of the ways they dealt with it was by just changing the story, claiming that it was fake. So I'm condensing an argument here, but I hope people are following me, that I see the charge of faking it as partially a response to the changes in the digital age, which made every Palestinian possibly an eyewitness at the site of Israeli state or settler violence, and in ways that Israelis were uncomfortable with, and that this charge of faking it was one such response. So I'm going to stop there. I've given you a lot. I've given you bits and pieces. Let me say this, that the book is organized as a series of case studies. If you feel like I'm jumping, it's because I am jumping. It's organized as a series of case studies into these various communities on different sides of political lines, right? We've got everyone from Palestinian activists and Palestinian Israeli human rights workers on the one hand, to settlers and military on the other. And I'm interested in how all of them employed these digital tools as political tools, and how they all, in their own way, struggled in a sense. And so it's a study of each of these different institutions in the digital age to make the broader argument, of course, that the occupation has changed in the digital age, And so this is a slice of that story. Tony, why don't you jump in? I'm going to stop my screen share, but I could go back to any of these images if folks were interested.
Sure. Sure. I agree with you, but like the one in which the Israeli soldier walked up to the wounded Palestinian who had tried to stab people, shot him in the head, and got off.
Sure.
The video documentation of the assassination of Abu Akleh.
Right.
Recreation, even going back to where the military vehicle was and taking recreations of it. It doesn't matter a damn bit. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole problem with it. No matter how sophisticated the Palestinians get, sophisticated or credible B'Tselem gets, the real issue is that all of this information and evidence just isn't paid attention to by the international community. Nobody's coming down on Israel and stomping on them and saying, you're full of crap. Right. This took place. And that's what the frustration is that I have with this. I mean, I've seen the video of the assassinations of those two guys going down.
Right.
And you know, this fake news thing is, it brings out more than anything else that when people are convinced that their side is right,
yep,
they will not pay attention to the truth. And the people who have the truth cannot persuade even the most logical judiciaries to pay attention to it and provide punishment or condemnation.
Yeah, and I want to just go back, Tony, to, of course, Shireen Abu Akleh is in here, and in my longer conversation about this project, I talk a lot about it. So this is a clip from the military's response to the Abu Akleh claims, right? So first they say on May 11th, Palestinian terrorists fighting indiscriminately are likely to have hit Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Then they say on May 27th, no IDF, so that after all the evidence has come forward, as Tony's mentioning, no IDF soldier deliberately fired at a journalist. We investigated this. That is a conclusion. There is no other, so yes. And again, everyone, those present are familiar with this, but yes, the architecture, the denial is the evidence. In the cases that I've looked at, and in the Shireen Abu Akleh case, the volume of videographic forensic evidence they are indifferent to that. I mean, that's what's quite stunning. I think this is part of the reason B'Tselem stopped collaborating with the military, right, in legal trials, because they finally understood that this kind of dream of perfect evidence didn't make any sense in the post 2000 political landscape of Israel. There was no volume of evidence was enough to undo the ideology on the other side. No volume of evidence. But I do think what is interesting, Tony, so I agree with you, and yet at certain historical moments, a lot of work is done by the right to not just deny the evidence, but work with it and claim that it was fake. And I think there's something about that moment when they didn't just say, oh, we didn't do it. They say, look, you know, there's a for the anthropologist, that's important that we not just jump to the ideology, but we also look at how they're kind of trying to change world opinion, and they're doing it via the evidence.
Yeah.
They're not going to believe the evidence, but they're doing it through the evidence. But I certainly agree with you. And the Abu Akleh case has been absolutely stunning in this regard.
Yeah. One more little question, though. When the settlers start taking their video, I suspect a lot of it is edited. They leave out stuff.
Sure.
And I suspect the military does as well, too. So that this media group is probably leaving out a lot of what we would take to be evidence.
Of course. Of course. I'll let Tony come back in, but I want to speak to that because
I've got to go. I got to go pick up my wife.
No problem. Thank you. Thanks for coming. Jeff, did you have your hand up? Uli, you had your hand up?
Yeah, I've got my hand. Yes, I've got my hand up.
Okay.
And I'm sorry Tony left because I disagree with him.
Oh, okay.
Tony was basically saying all this photographic evidence is doing no good at all. Mm-hmm. And it clearly is what we've seen is a change in attitude, both among right. people and governments mm-hmm. over a decade. And why not ascribe that to this photographic evidence?
Well, I think that's a really powerful response, because and I'm going to come back to my Abu Akla material if I could. So I'm just going to share here, and I'm going to come to, let's see, where is it? People are seeing what I've got. Do I have it? Okay, so this is the Washington Post report on This is the Washington Post report on Shireen Abu Akla. I assume everyone here has read this, right? And notice that it's called visual forensics. This report is based almost entirely on a videographic record produced by Palestinian bystanders at various points in Jenin refugee camp around the time of her shooting. So to come back to Jeff's argument, right? This material is basically crowdsourced videographic material, which produces the evidentiary record on which outlets like the Washington Post, CNN, et cetera, establish conclusively military responsibility for Abu Akla's death. And then I will, in a more technologically sophisticated way. So these are some of the videos on which the Washington Post pulled. Just, you know, again, these are shot by bystanders, right? I don't know if folks are familiar with the group Forensic Architecture, but they used this body of material with their incredibly complex technological apparatus to recreate the shooting. I mean, this is all based on, I'd like to read the quote here on the side. They say, "Our investigation is the first to employ a precise digital reconstruction of the incident," by which they're referring to the killing of Abu Akla. "Using advanced spatial and audio analysis, we track the location and movements of the various actors. By geolocating individual frames from the videos we sourced, we could establish and reconstruct within our digital model the exact positions of Shireen and other journalists, as well as the position of military vehicles in relation to them." So this is, I mean, and their record is incredible, what they've put together. So to come back to Jeff's point, this is all crowdsourced material from the smartphones of Palestinians in the vicinity, not even at the site, in the vicinity of the killing of Shireen Abu Akla, only made possible by the eyewitness camera. Now, sorry, Jeff, remind me of the guy, Tony would argue, well, doesn't matter, right? Because the Israeli military is going to respond the way the Israeli military always responds. But I do think that this is a massive sea change in the kind of evidence that can be gathered about these kinds of killings. And in every case, there are those eyewitnesses with their cameras. And in every case, this kind of work can be done through crowdsourced video. So these technologies in their ubiquity have radically changed the landscape. I don't think there's any way we can deny that point. What it does for military responsibility is something else. Ula, you were gonna jump in.
Dick, I think you had your hand up. I think you muted.
And I see Dick's point in the chat. Why don't you say, you wanna say something more about that, Dick? Sure. I'm gonna go back to that slide. Whoops. Sorry, let me go back.
You're muted.
Okay. Is your point that the accumulating mass of data, especially photographic data, will gradually whittle away at public policy, like the U.S.?
I can't say that with confidence. But what I'm saying is, there's no doubt. I mean, we've seen massive shifts in popular opinion. Absolutely, right. I mean, we're seeing it, despite what the LA Jewish Journal is telling folks. Right. To return to my mother's point, we're seeing massive shifts in public opinion, and I do think that, you know, when we have the availability of this kind of material, it is very, very powerful. Will it change the military's structure of accountability? Will it change legal proceedings? Will it change outcomes in military courts? No. Will it change, you know, did it have any effect on the elections in Israel? No. But I do think there's no denying the power of these platforms. There's no denying. So I can't prognosticate about U.S. policy, but popular opinion, absolutely. Uli, I wanted to let you jump in.
So I actually want to get your reaction to something that happened a little bit earlier, a few years earlier. The first time, the case of Elo Azaria, the Israeli medic who shot. And I think that actually can buttress the whole conversation because there was a major shift in the Israeli popular opinions because a lot of Israelis for the first time saw immutable pictures that you couldn't say they were fake. And even it got to the point that they were actually forced to bring him to military court or actually convict him. So, and this was really the first major one that I remember. It happened about 5-6 years ago. I don't remember exactly the date.
2016, so, April.
April 15?
No, April 2016.
16, yeah, 6 years ago. And I think that that actually, I don't know about the American, but I know that in the Israeli political discourse, things shifted since then. Because on one hand, I can tell you the fact that this about to become a new government, they want to put actually a clause that we are going to support our soldiers.
Yeah,
this is the big cry in the past 6 years that Israeli politicians are actually sacrificing the soldier on the front line, and they use Elo Azaria as the biggest example. So I just threw the ball at you. Whatever your reaction, whatever you respond from that, or what do you conclusion out of it?
Right. Well, Uli, you anticipated the introduction of my book because it starts with Elo Azaria, and I'm gonna actually show it because of course it has to, right? I'm gonna share my screen here. But it starts in a slightly different idiom and a less perhaps hopeful one. So this is Elo Azaria as man of the year. This is Elo Azaria as man of the year. So I'll remind people that we're talking about a point blank execution at close range by medic Elo Azaria in Hebron. He executed a Palestinian man who had tried to commit a stabbing. He was, in the military language, neutralized, lying wounded on the ground. Elo Azaria on camera, shot from an adjacent rooftop by a Palestinian man working with the B'Tselem Project. He captures the whole thing on camera. He meticulously walks towards this Palestinian man who's been injured and executes him. The entire thing happens on camera, and it immediately goes viral, circulated by B'Tselem. And this is my book starts here. And it actually starts here. And this is a case in which, as Uli says very rightly, there was no claim that was at least popularly endorsed that the footage had been faked. There was an acceptance, and it was a kind of bizarre in a way, and given the history that I've outlined, there was a bizarre in a way acceptance of the evidence. But I read it differently than Uli. I mean, yes, there is this now struggle between the military and the public. The military want to bring him to what is called by many a kind of show trial, right? Use him as the example to show that the military remains the most ethical military in the world. He is brought on trial. There's a split between the Israeli public and Elo Azaria. This is much discussed in the popular press. How could, you know, the public turns against the military. The military want to put him on trial. The public says no. Why do they say no? Because he's our hero. Why is he our hero? He tried to save us, right? He committed an execution he saved the Jewish people. Then there's a big movement afoot to try to render every execution of a Palestinian legal if that Palestinian is thought to pose a threat. He's here. Here we see him on the front page of a popular Israeli magazine named Man of the Year. The executioner is named Man of the Year. So I think that I read this a little differently than you do, Uli. I mean, I think there's a lot of stories that this incident tells. It tells a story about the relationship to the military. It tells a story about this. And that was a very important, in a way, turning point. For me, it's also part of this history about fake news claims. When is the footage considered threatening enough to be charged as fake? When is it not? What does it mean that the public accepted this? But I do think that one of the things that we learn about this incident is the Israeli pop. So this footage of this of execution is running viral in a kind of George Floyd-esque scale. In fact, it's likened to the O.J. Simpson trial in terms of the spectacularity of the footage and the trial that follows. That's how popular it is as a media event for Israelis. But again, I think it's a very tragic moment because again, the executioner becomes the hero. So this incident tells many stories, and it is without a doubt, I agree with Uli, it is a landmark in many ways as part of the story that we're telling. Uli, did you want to say anything else about that?
No, I think what you pointed out, that the Israeli military got caught between two stories. One story is we are the most moral army in the world. That's an oxymoron in its face, but the Israelis were willing to take it at face value. We are a moral army. See all the nice thing we do for all our enemies.
Yeah.
We take them to hospitals. Here we dealt with the Syrian revolution. We let a lot of the Druze in our hospital and on and on. So we are nice. We are nice Jews. We are nice Israelis. We don't do these kind of things that the bad guys do. On one hand. On the other hand, people look at the picture and they say, wait, this is an Israeli soldier who's doing something while he is on duty, mm-hmm. even though theoretically, the guy was neutralized, and the Israeli order in the army is you don't do anything. But the moment that they neutralize, you don't do. Here comes a medic, and instead of rendering extra help or some kind of first aid or anything, point blank, he executes him. Right. Now the army has a dilemma. How do we deal with it?
Yeah,
it cannot be both. And the whole populist thing that it stirred underneath, that Bibi actually loved, is like, now we stand behind our soldiers. In other words, right. They can do whatever we want. We'll give you the full backing.
Yes.
And now it got to the point that the whole conversation in the Israeli secular populace, at least, they say, wait a second. All of a sudden, we have people who were indoctrinated in the ultra-Orthodox, or not ultra, the Zionist, what do you call them, the Chardalim, the I don't know how to call them in English, the movement that that all of a sudden we have colonels and generals running the Israeli army. These people went for the yeshivas. In other words, they're influenced by Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook. By the Kukia, and these are soldiers that actually getting their backing, the wind behind from these generals who now run the Israeli army, which is anathema to people who served in the Israeli army 50 years before,
sure. Who
says the Israeli army doesn't do things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that created some kind of a fissure between the Israelis and the Americans, because especially the young Americans, some of them were in Taglit and all that, and all of a sudden they see two split screens and say, wait a second, somebody is not telling me the truth. What's happening here? You cannot reconcile the two pictures. I hear propaganda on one side, on the other side. What do I do with this? And
sure.
I think that they started, the Israeli politicals started to realize that they're losing the American Jewish support, especially of the millennials.
Mm-hmm.
They say, we are losing them. They're taking the side, and they give example of the BDS and they're supporting the Palestinians and on and on. So I think part of it, at least we can point at this point in time for Lower Zaria, is kind of a shift. I'm not sure that this is the whole story. Obviously, 2007-08, the led, what do you call it, Oferet Yetzuka, cast.
Yeah.
Led in Gaza, and then the 212, and then you saw how the Israelis dropped a bomb on this CNN building in Gaza and demolished a 15 stories building, and all of a sudden
Al Jazeera, people
say, wait a second, we were supposed to be the David, the nice guys, and the world is doing it to us, and after us, and all of a sudden, what's going on? We are killing them. And the joke started being in Israel is very simple. Before you kill a Palestinian, make sure he's not an American citizen.
Because yeah, right.
That's a problem. If he's an American right. citizen, you're done. If he's not, you can kill. That's no problem. So
sure.
yeah, so that's kind of my take on that.
No, I think that's really powerful. And I'm going to send you, Neve Gordon wrote a review of my book that really focuses on the Azalea case. I'll send it to you, Uli. But I do think it's a very powerful moment. It's a very powerful, tragic, I mean, and unbelievable. And again, for me, this video evidence is really core to the story. Jeff, you wanted to jump in. Oh, I'm sorry. Can I just say one more thing to Uli about the military piece? It reminded me that the other actors that I didn't mention that are part of this book are Breaking the Silence soldiers. So they're also part of the story. It's really, really an important part of the story. I particularly follow soldiers who were military photographers during their service, and then, you know, broke the silence, got radicalized during their service. And the role of their camera work, particularly as snipers in that storyline. So that's another episode that I talk about. Jeff.
Well, it's interesting that when a soldier starts thinking humanitarian, you say he becomes radicalized. But
right.
But I'm interested in how the world legal situation deals with the video evidence. Does the ICC and the IJC take it as just another line of evidence? And how does the military's use of the social media conflict with, or is it in concert with, the Fourth Geneva Convention?
You know, those are questions that are beyond my scope, but I'll tell you that particularly the first question around the ICC and the IJC around video evidence. I mean, the book, part of my book is trying to track early days. I mean, like any book project, it takes you into territory you don't expect to be wading through. But one of the territory I ended up wading through for this project was the kind of legal history of videographic evidence. When does it start to appear in military courts, and how is it handled as evidence? What is it? You know, how does the court have to adapt? How does the legal profession have to adapt to videographic evidence? And you know, the Rodney King case is a famous story around just this in the US context. I think folks are familiar with that, but I don't know. So I tracked a little piece of the history of this starting around 2008 when this footage starts to appear in courts. I don't know the answer to the question about the ICC and the IJC, but I'm very, very interested in this.
It's been clear for 20 years, 30 years that Photoshop can do amazing things to change.
Right.
So how does the legal system deal with the potential for photoshopping?
Right. Well, so the Photoshop in particular, that platform, folks who may remember the Second Lebanon War, there was a lot of Photoshop activism during the Second Lebanon War where videographic evidence was concerned, that there was a lot of claims that Israelis were photoshopping the evidence, Hezbollah was photoshopping the evidence, That has a longer history than just now. Photoshop precedes social media, of course. But let me say this in a slightly more historicist vein to answer your question, Jeff, that one of the things that interests me around the legal case is how the footage starts to move into legal arenas, starts to move into the military courts. And it's a problem for the right, right? It's a problem. And one of the ways the problem gets solved is the rise of a new kind of legal expert. And it's the expert in Palestinian media manipulation. They start to show up in courtrooms, these people. They're identified in this way. Expert in Palestinian media manipulation. And the key experts that are called, this may not surprise you, are the same experts that are called to invalidate the El Dura footage. It's the same people. It's the same actors. So the story of El Dura is really important in this book. As an early case around this. So it's the very same people who show up in this self-proclaimed title as, experts in media manipulation find their way into the courtroom, right, in an effort to speak against the validity of the footage. So that's that story's in there too. So that doesn't respond to your question, but it's you know, new kinds of expertise have to be marshaled, I guess, is what I'm saying, in legal arenas to try to deal with the problem of this evidence. Yeah, Dick.
Unmute yourself.
I had a background question. It's the Vietnam War had a lot of coverage of battle scenes, of mm-hmm. casualties, especially CBS.
Right.
And I've read that that's one of the reasons that the military adopted a policy of embedded reporters rather than independent reporters mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. you know, Chris Hedges or someone.
Right.
I mean, does that phenomena, is that something that you've addressed, or is that kind of prior to what you're talking about?
It is prior, but I mean, it's a really crucial, it's a really crucial proposition about Vietnam, the first living room war. This question of how much television, so, you know, in the story of media and the battlefield, the Vietnam case looms large as the question of, you know, popular opinion being swayed by the image. And I think, I think we're talking about a very interesting counter case, and especially what Uri's talking about, especially with the Elul Azalia case, right? Israeli popular opinion was not swayed by footage of an execution at close range. They rallied behind the executioner. So again, I think these historical precedents are, you know, this is a very crucial one. So yes, it's crucial in the story. It's very bizarre how it functions, and tragic how one might read the counterpart in the Israeli case. And I would say the same thing about Gaza. Like, look what happens in 2021, in Gaza in 2021. So one of the other mini stories that I'm chronicling here is you have these recurrent, you know, mowing the lawns in Gaza. You have Israel's recurrent incursions of the Gaza Strip, assaults on the Gaza Strip from 2008 to 2021. And along the way, the Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip is getting more and more digitally literate. In 2008, the reason the military was so proud of its content was because they had the content, right? As one will remember, there was a blockade on journalists from entering the Gaza Strip. Foreign journalists and Israeli journalists could not enter the Gaza Strip during 2008. The military controlled the media narrative very conclusively, certainly in the first 25 days. So as one moves further and further in time, the volume of digital tools at this disposal of Palestinians, despite the electricity outages, despite the constraints on internet infrastructure, grows, right? And the military starts to see its own messaging failing because the world is getting the messages of Palestinians under bombardment with their own cameras. So I guess I'm coming back to Vietnam to say, the footage we saw from 2021 out of Gaza was indeed radicalizing for the world. We've all seen how that worked. What's remarkable is how it failed to radicalize in Israel. And that's where my eyes are.
Yeah. And did the mob, I'm sorry, I was gone. Did Mavi Marmara have anything to do with it? Because
yeah.
there was an awful lot of video from the Palestinians on that boat.
Yep, that's in the book too. Mavi Marmara is a crucial story. Mavi Marmara is a key case, and the military sees the Mavi Marmara. So I have a whole chapter on the military lamenting its own media failures. Like, oh, if it would have gone better, popular opinion would have been swayed if only we'd had, you know, better footage. So the Mavi Marmara is the key case.
Okay.
Is the key case. Like they say, well, it's because we couldn't. You know, in the Mavi Marmara case, there's a kind of crazy story. Whoops, should we, Dick, if you can mute, I think we're hearing your background sound there.
Sorry.
No problem. But no, Tony, I was gonna say that the Mavi Marmara, I managed to have an interview with an Israeli spokesperson who told me this crazy story about how the military had this plan, and the plan was they were gonna take the footage and put it on the helicopter. This is all pre, you know, streaming capacity. They're going to take the footage. They're going to put it on the helicopter. They're going to take it back to land. Then the foreign ministry had to give it the clearance, but instead they had to put the wounded on the helicopter. And so the footage gets delayed by hours and hours, and the activists. So that's a very for the military, that's a very important chronicle of media failure that they always talk about. We can't have another Mavi Marmara.
Yeah.
And what's the end point of the story? The story is what happened for them in their eyes. It's not a story about military repression. It's a story about the enemy's media succeeded. They won the day. That's how the military tells the story of the Mavi Marmara.
Yeah. Wow. Important work you're doing.
Thank you. Uli.
I just wanted to add another aspect to the Mavi Marmara. The political thing was that Israel lost the political connection with Turkey. In other words, Turkey severed the diplomatic relationship with Israel because of the Mavi Marmara.
Yeah.
And that was really a pivotal point for the politicians in Israel.
Yep.
All of a sudden, they realize there is a price to pay politically and diplomatically for... They could blame the army, they could blame the navy, they could blame the PR department of the army and all that. But ultimately, it took them 10 or 12 years to repair the relationship.
Yeah.
Basically, Turkey was the first Muslim country that recognized Israel in, I think, in 49. Mm-hmm. And Israel always were proud about the fact we still have relationship with the Turks in 2009. And they, as a side to that thing, all those years, those 60 years that Turkey was actually in diplomatic relations with Israel, Israel refused to recognize the Holocaust of what the Turks did in 1915.
Mm-hmm. So the Armenians, yeah.
The Armenian Holocaust was something that Israelis, one of the only places in the world who would not condemn that.
Mm-hmm.
And people always came to the Jews and say, you have the monopoly on the Holocaust. All of a sudden, nobody can compete with your Holocaust. Mm-hmm. The Armenian and the Holocaust, it doesn't count. You don't recognize it. So that was a very pivotal conversation on the political realm. And I remember at the time that I actually sent a letter to the members of the Knesset and say, guys, here is your point of political winning. Declare the Armenian Holocaust as a Holocaust, and the state of Israel realizes and recognizes it as a finger back to Erdogan. And they didn't do that.
Right.
Anyhow.
Yeah, Halavai. I'll want to add one more thing on the Mavi Marmara, which is the military had this storyline that, like, you know, if only our cameras are in the right place, if only we shoot the Palestinian bad guy, you know, film the Palestinian bad guys at the right moment, if only we're controlling the editing, then the world will see the righteousness of our cause. They have a story about the kind of right, if there's enough media, the righteousness of our project will be visible and everyone will see it. So but the flip side of that is when the cameras are rolling, the military, you know, so in the Mavi Marmara, is the Israeli media called that a lynch on board, right? That was perceived as that was the language used by the Israeli media. There was a lynch of Israeli soldiers by the Palestinian commandos. That was the language that they used. So there was also this kind of macho language of embarrassment. You know, the camera was rolling and there was a lynch. So there's this other piece too, which is the military doesn't want to be defeated on camera. So there's a lot of anxiety about losing on camera.
Yeah.
In key military junctures that the military comes back to over and over again.
There was that key piece of film showing the wounded Israeli soldiers on the Mavi Marmara being taken down to first aid below, so they wouldn't be hit accidentally by the Israeli soldiers up above them.
Right.
And they were scared to death that they were going to be killed, and they were taken care of. Right. And that was documented all the way through. And of course, you know, the other documentation was the American, the binational kid, the American and Turkish citizen who was killed. And the Americans still haven't done a damn thing about it.
Right.
Well, it's a battle.
It's a battle. It is a battle. But these are really, I really appreciate the conversation. Jeff, do we want to keep rolling or do we want to, this has been great.
No, I was about to start closing it up. Oh, there are two windows that haven't said a word, Ruth Persky and the senior Professor Stein.
I think the senior Professor Stein has a bad cold, but maybe he wants to weigh in.
he's covering the screen. Hey,
I'd like to say
he's coming to unmute himself.
I'd like to say something. Because I know my own daughter, I know her passion for this subject since she's about 18 years old and went on a junior year abroad in Israel and saw all the injustice. I appreciate the energy it takes for her to do what she does. But I also appreciate her audience because you are all obviously incredibly dedicated men. And it comes through in your questions and in how much you care about the future of Israel. And I must say, everything you bring up just is so profoundly tragic. Every avenue that Israel seems to be going down just becomes more and more tragic. And it's just so hard to remain as dedicated as we want to be to this subject, because Jews in America just don't get it at all. They just don't seem to get it. But I do think they are losing support. I think it is clear that the next generation is never going to support them the way the previous did. So what can I say? Rebecca, thank you so much. And for all of you who asked wonderful questions and know so much, I appreciate you. Thank you.
Okay. Did you want to say something, Ruth, or should we just push on?
I'm sorry, I can't. I had a hearing problem and I came in late, despite your many, many, many notices that it's starting early. I forgot. I apologize.
No problem. I'm glad you came.
So did Yossi and various other people. Okay, so I'm going to thank Rebecca, and we thank you very much. I sent Rebecca a note today about a lunch that we might do later in the week or when you're here. And if you're interested in that, let us know. Anyway, I thank everybody for coming. And in 1 month, we have Uri talking, trying to make sense of the situation. I will point out that Gideon Levy found a positive way to think about the new situation.
He's got the Lenny theory. The worse it gets, the better it gets. Yeah, that's the Lenny theory. Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Thanks to everyone for coming. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks, everyone.
Best of luck with your work.
Thank you so much. Take care.
For Judy Levin.
Bye-bye, everybody.